Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Monday, the 22nd of November. All things political, which we always have Mondays at 9. It was 47 years ago President John Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. This day in history, I think we'll make mention of that sometime during the course of this hour. We have a lot to talk about. Don't Ask, Don't Tell we'll be looking at. What's the deal with the new START treaty that the president negotiated with the Russians? There seems to be some concern about whether or not it's going to pass. Why is it controversial? The deficit, of course, among the topics we'll be discussing. Unemployment benefits expiring, extending the Bush-era tax cuts, which is a topic we've been on for quite some time. I guess we can't ignore Sarah Palin. As I was saying earlier, Frank Rich has an interesting column all about Sarah Palin yesterday in which he really believes that the top of the ticket is hers. For 2012. We'll talk about that possibility and see whether our guest agrees with that. Our guest, we hope to have him with us in a moment, is Lawrence Jacobs, professor and director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota. We're just trying to reach him on the phone. I hope that happens momentarily. He has areas of expertise in presidential and legislative politics, elections and voting behavior, public opinion and polling, American political history, Midwestern swing states, third-party politics, Social Security, and healthcare policy. And he can certainly talk about how the Midwest became much more conservative and why that happened in the midterm elections. He's a very prolific author, and he is written 9 scholarly books and many, many articles, and has done some pretty remarkable conferences at the University of Minnesota. So he will be with us. Well, I'm thinking of he is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair in Political Studies, and we are going to have Walter Mondale with us, actually. Walter Mondale has written a book, and he will join us on December 9th at 10 o'clock, in case you want to mark that down. We have a lot of really good political shows coming up. Richard Wolff is joining us tomorrow at 10 o'clock. He has a brand new book, Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the White House. And it's there are a number of people in Washington have already read this book, have obviously been anticipating the book. One of the things in Maureen Dowd's column yesterday, she mentions the book, saying that inside the White House, the president drove Rahm Emanuel crazy by spending his first months in office toiling on the details of START when the chief of staff was trying to get him to focus on the economy and his domestic agenda. Nuclear arms control, Wolf writes, was one of Obama's first interests as a student at Columbia University, and his head is still in those wonky clouds. So we will be talking about that a little bit later. Well, tomorrow, actually, later, with Richard Wolff. And James Fallows is going to join us tomorrow at 9 o'clock. He is just a marvelous writer and thinker. He has a piece in the Atlantic Monthly, and he'll be joining us tomorrow at 9. What else do I want to tell you? Well, I'll tell you about 10 o'clock while we try to reach our guests. We'll have the editor of the Environmental Magazine, E, with us the second hour of our program today, has a very interesting article on certified passive houses. There are only about 13 in this country, but in Europe, there are many schools and businesses and factories and homes that are certified passive homes. What makes something certified passive? We'll talk about that. They use 90% less energy for heating and cooling than an average home, reducing total energy consumption to between 60 to 70% less than a conventional home. So we'll be speaking with the editor of E, the Environmental Magazine, and she's the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Renewable Energy for Your Home. Well, I don't know where Larry is. I hope he's okay, because he's usually quite dependable. We will try to find him momentarily. In the meantime, I would suggest that we just take some phone calls on some of those issues that I brought up, because you can carry our all things political. Whatever you would like to talk about. I had mentioned the Kennedy assassination. That decade certainly changed American politics. I don't know if that was forever, but those of us who lived through that incredibly dismal week and decade in many ways will remember that day quite vividly. What about Don't Ask, Don't Tell? Do you think that Congress should act on this immediately? The START treaty that the president worked on so diligently, which it looks as though the Senate is not going to ratify this treaty. Why do you think that's the case? The deficit, of course, is big news. Let me give you our phone number in case any of these strike your fancy while I'm talking about them. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And you can also send an email. Well, don't do that. Just call, because otherwise, who will I have to talk to? Just call. 800-486-8655. Unemployment benefits expiring. It looks like that will happen. We can certainly talk about that. Extending the Bush-era tax cuts. What do you think is the best plan here? Should they expire for the wealthy? Should they not expire for the wealthy? Does it make a difference in terms of creation of jobs and the economy if we go one way or the other? All right, until we find our guest, may we chat about all of those issues and whatever else you would like to discuss on this All Things Political. And we'll find our guest, we hope, momentarily. David in Ironwood, Michigan is first. Hello, David.
Well, I want to start out with the environment. It seems to be off the thing more than it should be. I urge everyone, even if you don't believe that climate change, learn the science. Start to look into it yourself. I mean, I was a little skeptical, and when I start looking into it, it is scary. We're talking about maybe the possible extinction of the human race if we don't start doing something.
So
it really is. I mean, find out. The news should be, this would be front page daily. I mean, we need to do something to save this planet.
So you would like to see Congress take on this issue in a big way?
Oh, not the Congress. The whole world needs to do this.
Okay. Thank you, David, very much for your call and your concern. We go to Tom from Fond du Lac next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen. I thought I'd help you out of your dilemma.
Thank you, Tom. I'm in a pickle.
on another matter. I don't know if everybody read the article in the Journal Sentinel yesterday about a physician in Green Lake who is changing his practice to no longer accept insurance. He only accepts cash, no Medicare payments, no insurance. And years ago, I used to be a pharmaceutical representative, and I called on this man as a young physician just entering practice, and I was immediately impressed with him, you know. And I think he might be onto something. He's made his money, and now he's conducting a 2-year experiment to see if this will work. To see if he can make a living without insurance. He's eliminated a great deal of overhead from his practice.
Well, who's going to go to him if you don't have an insurance? I mean, has he lowered his rates for everybody? Or?
Yes, he's lowered his rates by about 2/3, apparently.
Uh-huh.
And you can go in and see him for like $39 or something like that, you know, within probably almost anybody's reach. Obviously, he's not going to do major surgery or anything like that. He's a general practitioner.
Right.
The gateway to the medical system.
Right. And he won't accept any form of insurance.
That's my understanding, according to the article on the front page of the Journal Sentinel yesterday.
Okay. I read the paper, but I must have skipped that. I didn't read that. All right. Well, we'll check into that.
It's a real interesting, you know, it could restore people's, trust or satisfaction in the medical system. Nobody's happy, including the physicians.
Well, except that a lot of people don't have very much money to go. That's why we have Medicaid and Medicare. If you won't accept those kinds of patients, where are those people going to go?
Well, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll check it out.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
You bet.
Mm-hmm. Bye. Phil is calling from Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I just have a question about the Mitch McConnell statement that the Republicans are going to just have a standoff for 2 years to try and keep Obama from getting another term. And that is that when the Republicans do get back in office as president, can't the Democrats do the same thing that we're doing now to the Republicans, or that they're doing now to us, unless the Democrats are more patriotic and will want to see some progress made, as opposed to the Republicans who are willing to have a standoff. It would seem that Democrats can do the exact same thing, which is not cooperate.
That's assuming that the Republicans are not going to try to govern the next 2 years. You feel that they won't?
I feel that they will get away with that and won't, and probably will then get get the presidency back. But then once they get it back, I guess Democrats could do the very same thing to Republicans, say that we're not going to cooperate for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
I guess they could do that. Except that Democrats are usually more likely to want some progress made, maybe, than Republicans, who are willing to just stand around and do nothing and watch things crumble.
Yeah. It would be hard to believe that the Republicans would be able to take the presidency if there's not a plan that they put forward and if they don't govern in some way in the next 2 years.
Yeah, but it's kind of happened just recently with the election we just had. They haven't done anything. It's hard to remember something the Republicans have done for the people of the United States in recent memory. But still, they get elected.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what do you think about Sarah Palin at the top of the ticket?
Well, I think it would be a disaster. But on the other hand, she does appeal to a certain group of people who tend not to vote too much and don't pay attention too much. So it's certainly possible, I think, that she could be a bigger factor than people are giving her credit for. And some people say, well, really, she's probably not all that much different than Bush himself in her lack of knowledge on things. So I think she has a better chance than people give her credit for as of now, but a lot will change in 2 years, and
mm-hmm.
no doubt there will be others that will come to the forefront.
Yeah, she's really all over the place, isn't she? She's just amazing.
Yeah.
She's everywhere.
Yes, and I think she's making a lot of money at it.
Oh, no doubt about that.
So I don't think she will probably care if she doesn't get the top spot. But
thanks.
It's odd that she doesn't want to try something else, like maybe a lower-level House or a Senate or House position.
Uh-huh. Well, if you can go to the top.
Yeah, but I think if she were in the Senate or the House, it might detract from her ability to get the top position.
Right.
Because they see how she actually governs.
Well, I have fond memories of Crystal Lake, Illinois. My Aunt Margaret and Uncle Dan O'Leary lived in Crystal Lake.
Oh.
He was a conductor for the Chicago Northwestern. And after he passed away, we would go out and pick up Aunt Margaret and bring her for Thanksgiving dinner.
Oh, yeah. And you're from Harvard, I think.
My father was from Harvard. And then we lived in Hyde Park and Des Plaines and then Elk Grove Village.
Oh, well, how nice.
Yeah, yeah. So,
well, A native,
yeah. Thank you, Phil. Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye. My friend Rick Horowitz, who I did a television show with for many years, who does commentary for public television here in the city of Milwaukee and also does a syndicated column and quite a bit of writing for Huffington Post, heard that we were in trouble. So he's going to join us for a few minutes and welcome phone calls for him. He's always up on the news. We get together for lunch and talk about the news all the time. So it'll be as though we're all having coffee together. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
How are you doing?
You were listening and sensed that I was in trouble, huh?
I heard that you'd been stood up for breakfast, so I figured I would call in and find out if you wanted an emergency backup conversation partner.
All right, let's do it.
So emergency edition of All Things Political.
Thank you, Rick.
Glad to. How are you doing?
This is kind of fun. I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
You know, I was realizing just when I went on the air, I used to really follow this. I was mentioning that it was 47 years ago today that President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. I was alive during that time.
Yes,
I remember that. I'm wondering what kind of impact that had on American politics, Rick. When you think about that day, it was a horrible decade in many ways. It was the first of several assassinations, and we kind of lost our trust in government in a way. Have we restored it at all?
I don't know that we've restored it. It was sort of, people seem to think it was the first step on the road of not trusting government. It was followed by the Vietnam War. It was followed by Watergate. And people basically got out of the habit of both believing what the government was telling them and believing that things would remain stable because they became so unglued for such a long period of time. It's interesting. In September, I was in Dallas for an editorial writers conference, and they took us to the Sixth Floor Museum, which is the museum that's been made out of the school book depository, the building from which Lee Harvey Oswald shot at and killed the president.
Yes.
And I've been there a couple of times before. This time, though, we had a person from the museum or a historian in town who was telling us something about the time and about the anger that was afoot, at least in Dallas and in parts of Texas at the time of the president's visit down there. And the questions were pretty much unavoidable about whether there are parallels in today's political environment with people as angry as they are, with people as upset as they are with the president, with particular policies, with the country as polarized as it's become. And there were people in our group who, and I count myself among them, who worried for this president's safety, that there are moods out there once you start declaring the president, you know, a communist, a socialist, a fascist, just like Mao, just like Stalin, just like Hitler. Well, once you've declared him an enemy of the state, you've sort of put a target on his back, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly.
And that, I think, was troubling to a number of us, that I mean, to your question of whether we've restored faith in government, I'm not sure we have. And in some respects, the anger is even more widespread. Now, you can talk about all sorts of reasons for that. You've got, you know, 24/7 cable news trying to fill their airwaves, and so they need things they can talk about, and controversy is easier to get people ginned up about than sort of a sober discussion about the issues, the kinds of things you're doing. And it makes it troublesome and worrisome, I guess, to those of us who are observing this thing, that there are as many angry people out there and as many opportunities for them to either vent or act on their anger.
Right. Yeah. I'm longing for the good old days of Bob Dole and people like that who were
Those are now
civil.
Moderates. Those are now
they
the,
are
the
moderates
sensible
now.
The sensible center, and you wonder if there's any place for that anymore. You saw that, obviously, and I know you guys have talked about this in the recent election, where you had the even the moderate Democrats, many of them found the Blue Dogs found themselves voted out, and what remains of the moderate Republican Party is basically two women from Maine and maybe Scott Brown in Massachusetts.
Right.
And it's hard to figure out how you get things done in the center if there's no center.
Yeah. Let's talk about this START treaty for a moment, this new START
sure.
treaty. We're going to have Richard Wolff on tomorrow who writes about it. I haven't read the book yet. That's this afternoon's task. But
that's
evidently,
revival, I guess, right? Yeah. It's his new book.
Yeah. Yeah. He evidently talks about this being a priority because the president worked when he was at Columbia on arms control. It was something that was of deep concern to him. Why is it that this particular treaty could be in trouble? Don't we want to have fewer nuclear weapons in this world?
We do. We also want to make sure, I guess, that the nuclear weapons we do have are as up to date as they can be, the latest model of nuclear weapon. And there is at least some question, particularly on the Republican side, about whether the research development modernization is up to snuff. What is particularly peculiar, though, and for people who, you know, who are watching the political side of this as much as the arms control side, is that there didn't seem to be that much concern with it up to just now. There were, I believe, 18 or so hearings and briefings on the thing. There were questions answered. There was a massive increase in funding that Obama and his administration approved, and then another $4 billion thrown into the pot just this last week or two as a sweetener to Senator John Kyle, who, as you know, is the Republican point man on issues nuclear in the Senate,
mm-hmm.
and most of the Republicans there take their lead from him. And to get the treaty ratified, they need, I believe the number is 9 Republican votes. They need two-thirds majority of the Senate to approve treaties. And there's some feeling, I don't know that you can, there's a smoking gun about it, but there's some feeling that yet again the Republican priority here is to deny Obama a victory, even though, as you said in your question, the victory would be a victory for security, for nuclear security, for trying to cut the supply that is already out there down somewhat, that several other, many other past presidents, dating back to Reagan, have presented similar kinds of treaties to the Senate, and they have typically passed by wide bipartisan majorities. And so you sort of wonder why suddenly that has changed, and sadly, the most likely explanation seems yet again to be politics, that they'd rather not give him a victory at this point.
Let's go to some phone calls, and we'll be hopping around. You know the schedule here.
Sure.
Emily is calling from La Crosse. Hi, Emily.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to talk quickly about Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. I am really, really hoping that they go ahead and repeal that right away, as soon as possible, because I don't think that there's any way that that's going to happen with the new Republican government. And I think that it's really important, especially to young people, and especially considering something with all of the recent lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, teen and young people's recent suicides. I think it's really important to consider how we as a culture treat and value or devalue the roles of different minority people, including people who belong to a gender or sexual minority, and how that impacts kids. I mean, there is the movement of Lady Gaga really pushing for Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. And she got a lot of young people excited about and passionate about incorporating LGBT people in a positive way and valuing their work in the military. And I know that a lot of young people, you know, contacted their congresspeople and all that stuff, and it looked like really Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal was not going to happen. So I'm kind of wondering what your impressions are of whether or not this is going to happen, or whether or not it's probably going to be put on hold again.
Well, I would think that it is, if it's going to happen, it will not happen until December. It will not happen until the Pentagon report on the subject has been distributed to members of Congress. That's, as you know, the look they've been taking over the last few months at Secretary Gates's initiation to see what would be involved in implementing a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, how that would be done, and without what they worry about, negative impacts on military morale and unit cohesion and things of that sort. It seems pretty clear that Secretary Gates, as well as most of the heavy hitters in the administration, would like this thing repealed, and the sooner the better, for some of the same reasons you've mentioned. The callers mentioned that the Congress is not going to get any more favorably disposed to this with a new Republican House majority, although there are apparently majorities of both Republicans and Democrats who claim to favor repeal. I think.
Well, as do the American people, right?
Well, sure.
If you do a poll on that.
Yeah, and you even saw, to your caller's point, this ad a couple of weeks ago that Cindy McCain was a part of, John McCain's wife.
Right.
That was talking exactly about your caller's point, that if you single people out for mistreatment, for discrimination, they are more subject to bullying, they are more subject to emotional distress, they may be more subject to suicide. And so taking action on that ground is I think, a reasonable consideration as well. Obviously, from the military's point of view, they are, and this is where, for instance, the Marine commandant is sort of a holdout on this. We're talking about, you know, well, our troops are sleeping out in the open, and, you know, apparently he's worried that there will be, you know, predator troops going after their fellow troops, which seems beyond ridiculous. But it's a concern to at least the Marine commandant. And I think they're going to have to try to get all these people lined up, satisfied, quieted, something, in addition to people like John McCain, who's now out there saying, after months of saying, well, he'll listen to the military commanders, and if they say we can do it, we'll do it. Now he's saying, well, the survey that the Pentagon is taking on is focused on how to implement it, not whether it should be implemented. And he thinks, or at least claims to think now in his newly conservative persona, that you can't have a survey about how you would implement the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You have to basically go back to the earlier basic question of should you do it at all? And I think the people from Secretary Gates on down have basically said, yes, you should. We need to, acknowledging that there are now, you know, homosexuals, gays and lesbians in the military and have served honorably for generations, but that to make it official, to make it open, they have to figure out, you know, what concerns the troops and their staff up and down the chain have, and have to deal with that. So my hope is that they will be able to get it done before the end of the session. My fear is, as the caller's is that it will be delayed because, you know, you look at the number of things Kathleen mentioned at the introduction of the show, half of those things are supposed to be taken up in a couple of weeks when they haven't been taken up in all these months prior to this. And so just a traffic cop question, how much traffic can the Senate and the House handle, is something they'll have to deal with. What is encouraging, I guess, is what your caller also said, which is that clearly among young people, this is way less of an issue than it is among older folks. And so the trends on this issue, and they have, if you look at polls comparing now, public attitudes now would say even 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, there's been remarkable amount of movement on a whole range of issues having to do with LGBT populations.
Right. Yeah. Let's pause for a moment. We'll return. Rick Horowitz is joining us. We were to have had Lawrence Jacobs from the University of Minnesota, but we cannot find him this morning. And Rick was listening to the show, and he's up on all these issues. He's a syndicated columnist. He writes for Huffington Post. He does commentary for Interchange, which is a program on Wisconsin, Milwaukee public television on Fridays and Sundays. And so he called in. So we're talking with him. Here's our phone number for all things political, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can send an email, too, now, because we do have a guest, unexpected guest. We have much to talk about for all things political. We'll take on, of course, these tax cuts again, whether or not the Bush-era tax cuts will be extended. What are the Democrats' plans on this? We'll talk a little bit about the dissatisfaction that many progressive Democrats have with this president, and what it is that he could do to gather their support once again, or if he is becoming just not strong enough as a leader. Sarah Palin is all over the place. Frank Rich had an interesting column about her, and that the top of the ticket is hers, really, in 2012. So we'll be looking at all those issues and whatever you would like to discuss as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For all of you political people, tomorrow during this time, or during the 10 o'clock hour, Richard Wolff will be joining us. His new book, Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House, has just been published. Our number is 800-486-8655. We go next to Jeff from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I called in about your original topic about Sarah Palin, and I encourage everybody to look at the clip on YouTube that some enterprising videographer shot off air during a commercial break at Fox News, and it shows the opinion makers of Fox News ridiculing the woman. Now, that's all funny and whatnot, but that's not my point, really. My point is, if those who claim to support her off air think of her as somewhat ludicrous, it's just a signal of how low we have all sunk, and it almost seems to me some strange, I don't want to call it a sickness, but it's a strange feature of the American people that we could put forth, someone could put forth someone so clearly inexperienced and inarticulate as Sarah Palin, it almost seems to be a sort of bite your nose to spite your face phenomenon. And to imagine her representing us in some sort of international fora is so clearly inappropriate. And I almost wonder if it's not almost simply another tactic of the far right to make government actually as inept as they always claim it to be. And I encourage you to look at it. The title on YouTube is Fox Attacks Palin Off Air or something like
that. Yeah, I saw that somewhere in the Huffington Post, but I haven't seen it yet. Did you read Frank Richards' column yesterday, Jeff?
I have not.
Yeah, it's devoted to Sarah Palin. Yeah, it's devoted to her. And he says at the end, which is how I teased part of the conversation, there's little reason to believe now that she cannot dance to the top of the Republican ticket when and if she wants to. You think that's true? We'll ask Rick that in a moment, too.
Well, I think it's true because it almost seems as though she garners support by people who just want to make a gesture, you know, almost like a finger in the air at Washington by putting forward someone who's just laughing at it. I mean, it reminds me of when, you know, people laughed at FEMA and Michael Brown and how inept it was during Katrina, which is true. But it was inept because the Bush administration stripped it of hundreds of very experienced people. It used to be one of the best federal agencies in Washington, and it was stripped down to make it as inept as they want it to be. And this almost seems to be a sick way of doing the same thing, of putting someone there that everyone, including her supporters, knows she is not appropriate, and yet they continue with this folly to, I think it's almost just to make the federal government as, you know, I've said it, as inept.
Right, right. Rick, why is she all over the place? And she really has staying power.
Well, she's compelling. She says things that are quotable. She had probably what I consider the two most consequential words in the political debate of the last 2 years, and those two words were death panels. They scared the bejesus out of people. They slowed down the process. They put the Democrats on the defensive, which cost them time, which made the Democrats less able to focus on other things like the economy and jobs, which got more people ticked off. I think it really had an impact on the debate, not for good from my perspective and not for good sense because there was nothing to her claim. But certainly in terms of being able to drive the debate, I think she's had a great effect on things. I think your caller, I think Jeff is right to the extent that some people are using a Palin vote as sort of a way to stick a middle finger up to government and to Washington and say we're angry and we're not going to take it anymore. But to his image about cutting off your nose to spite your face, let me try a different image or a different cliche for you, and it's the old one about riding the tiger. I think a lot of people in the political establishment, in the Republican establishment, believe that it's all to the good to get the enthusiasm that she can gin up among the Republican faithful and the right side of the Republican faithful, right meaning far right as opposed to right and wrong, and to ride that enthusiasm into office, into power, take back the House, next time hope to take back the Senate and the White House, and then expect they can say to Palin, to the Christine O'Donnells of the world, to the Sharon Engels of the world, to the Joe Millers of the world, you know, okay, fine, thank you very much for your help. Now you guys step aside and, you know, we grown-ups will take over from here. And, you know, the Wall Street folks and the folks who've been in charge of the Congress for years as more establishment conservative Republicans rather than Tea Party folks, you know, the Mitch McConnells of the world. The problem is that I don't know that once they're riding that tiger, they can get off very well and tell the Palins and the Tea Party people, thank you very much, go home now, and we'll take it from here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they may be in for a big surprise. You were reading, I think, Kathleen, just in the days immediately following the election, that other Republican candidates for president in 2012, but the Republican establishment, such as it is trying to find somebody they can coalesce around,
right,
as an alternative.
They don't want her. Yeah, that's
right.
An interesting
battle. They don't think she's electable. I'm not certain that that's true, to be honest. Whether she's qualified, I think it's absolutely clear she's not qualified, but I don't think that means she's not electable.
Right.
And I think that some of the very folks who are most willing to use the energy of Palin, her supporters, Tea Party folks, their enthusiasm for their ends may find it more difficult than they ever imagined to take back the reins or to get off the tiger.
The other thing that's going on, and maybe she's filling a vacuum here or a void, I don't know, maybe it's just our obsession with reality TV and dancing shows. And I mean, that's another story that her daughter won the competition. Unbelievable. But what we also have going on is a great deal of criticism of this president by progressives in this country and by others who feel that he's just kind of fallen by the wayside. He just doesn't say very much about tax breaks, you know, for the wealthy. He doesn't seem to stand for very much anymore. And a lot of people are pretty upset with him. How do you assess the presidency of Obama? And why do you think so many people think he's just not doing the job?
I think there are a couple of reasons. But it's interesting, too. I was hearing on NPR this morning that he's hoping to do some more outreach to corporate CEOs because they think he's been terribly hard on business. And the NPR report was mentioning at the same time the corporate heads are screaming that he's cracking down too hard on them. Liberals and progressives in the Democratic Party are saying he's not tough enough, that he's pampering the corporate execs, that the bailouts, the TARPs, the Wall Street bailout are things that he should have been tougher on. And so he's really getting squeezed in both directions. It's a very difficult path he's got to carve out here to make that work. I think there are a couple of reasons why people are disappointed. Part of it is he ran as something of a blank slate. I mean, this is not an original thought of mine, but I've read it in a number of places, and I think it's probably accurate, that to the extent you run as a blank slate, people are able to project onto you their most fervent wishes. And he was just unknown enough that people could assume he was the great liberal hope. At the same time, independents were thinking, well, he's the moderate bipartisan work across the aisle guy. And so different people came in with, I think, different expectations about him. Beyond that, I mean, I think my disappointment is less that he hasn't tried as that he hasn't been able to get as much done as he hoped for, though if you take a look at the various accomplishments between, you know, the Lilly Ledbetter pay equity thing and the S-CHIP expansion and obviously the health care reform, which most Democrats are running away from now, Russ Feingold being a notable and, as you noticed, defeated exception to that. There have been a lot of things accomplished, but I think my sense of it was he had won by such a large margin in 2008 that the Republicans, just as a bow to political reality, would be obliged to work with him at least to some extent. And I have to admit I was completely wrong about that, that they decided that their only way back into power was to be the opposition party and to try to block him at every turn and slow him down and keep him from becoming the kind of transformative president that he had hoped to be and might still become.
I don't think he can do it anymore. Don't you think that some of the criticism of this is truly justified, that when he entered office, this country was in horrible shape? It's not in a whole lot better shape now, but Nancy Pelosi, it seems to me, has been in many ways a more progressive leader and has been able to forward an agenda when we didn't know what was on his mind, really, when it came to health care, et cetera.
Well, there are a couple things there, too. I mean, she had a much more liberal caucus that she could maneuver through. In the House, the Democratic House, with large majorities. So even if she lost various blue dogs and such, the conservative moderate Democrats, she could still get a majority for things she wanted. I think that one of Obama's faults, if you will, is that he thought that people could sort of reason together and work this out. He also, I think, overlearned the lessons of the Clinton administration when they showed up, Mr. and Mrs. Clinton, with a health care plan, all details of which were already worked out, and said, here it is, swallow this.
Mm-hmm.
And the Congress said, no, thank you. And so instead he went maybe too far to the other side and said, here's some ideas, you guys work it out, which presumably would give House and Senate members buy-in to the program. But what it also meant is you spent a gazillion, man hours trying to put together programs, trying to cut deals, trying to gain the one or two crucial Republican votes, trying to hang on to the one or two crucial, you know, Ben Nelson of Nebraska kinds of votes, Democrats who were, you know, about to jump to the Republican side on those issues, and cutting all sorts of deals that made people, disgusted is a reasonable word.
Yeah.
You know, and so you had that kind of thing, too. And some of it may just be a personal style issue, that he's not a dominator, here's what I want, my way or the highway, although I suspect some Republicans would say that's exactly what he's doing. I disagree with that, with their contention on that. That, you know, you had the sight of Max Baucus spending the better part of half a year trying to convince three Republicans on his committee to go along with him and support this thing long after it became clear to lots of people that that was never going to happen.
Let's pause for a moment and take more phone calls. Rick Horowitz is kind enough to join us for All Things Political. He is a commentator, syndicated columnist, and writes for the Huffington Post as well. Is from Milwaukee, and we have worked together for many years on public television. So our guest for this hour, we couldn't find, I hope he's okay, Lawrence Jacobs from the University of Minnesota. So Rick kindly called in, and we're bouncing ideas off him and you. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. Jeff from Madison, thanks for your call. A line is open at 800-486-8655 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program this Monday, we'll talk about passive homes. They're just starting to catch on in the United States. They're expensive to build, but they use 90% less energy for heating and cooling than the average home. So that's coming up, hour number two. It's All Things Political this hour. Our next caller is Tom from Oconto. Hello, Tom.
Yes. Something that hasn't been brought up, but which all women should be aware of. Last week, the Republicans held up the vote on the pay equality bill in the Senate. It will not come up for a vote. Although this passed with a good majority in the House, it looks like equal pay for women is something that isn't going to happen. This was opposed by the Chamber of Commerce and also the Small Business Associations. And as far as Palin, I do hope she gets to run, and I hope she is, because that's the only way Obama's going to get reelected. I have very conservative relatives who would vote for Obama before they'd vote for her.
Hmm. What about a challenge to both of them? What, we haven't mentioned Bloomberg here at all, and this talk about Bloomberg, Joe Scarborough. What about adding that element? Is the country ready for that? Would you vote for that ticket, Tom? Or do you know? Would your relatives vote for that ticket?
No. I'd vote for Obama again.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Equal pay and the Bloomberg situation, Rick?
Bloomberg says, at least now, that he's not running in 2012. I'm willing to take him at his word. At the minute, no other Democrat says that he, or to make it more explicit, she, is interested in running against him in 2012. It is early yet. I mean, it is the case that he's sitting in the polls roughly where Reagan was sitting in 82 after the midterm elections of his first term, and where Clinton was sitting in 94 after the midterm elections of his first term. And both of them went on to, in Reagan's case overwhelmingly, and in Clinton's case comfortably, win re-election. So I think it really is early to figure that out, to figure out whether there will be opposition. I think if he stays down in the mid low 40s or drops further, you'll start seeing some nervousness,
right,
particularly on the left, and people looking to find somebody better. And I think at that point the pressure will mount, and you'll start hearing presumably more denials from Hillary Clinton that she's got any interest in this.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, obviously, she's the person the liberal wing of the party would most likely be inclined to look at. On the pay equity thing, I think it may be just one more example of what we were talking about before on your previous call, which is that there is not a consensus to get a lot of stuff done right now. It was a 58-41 vote to take it up, and they needed 60 again to get past Republican threatened filibuster on the thing. And once again, you're hearing, the chamber and Republican opposition to this thing prevent stuff that Democrats would like to get done.
Thanks, Tom, for your call. Margaret, my favorite name in Lake Geneva. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I am calling. You had commented about this being the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination.
Yes.
And Rich had mentioned that that was sort of the beginning of a cynicism in government. I think that that skepticism, I guess, about government has always been with us. We've always had Rush Limbaugh's. It was a priest outside of Detroit. I can't remember what his name was in the
30s. Father Coughlin. Yes.
And I think that Obama has a wonderful opportunity, actually, to restore some faith in government. I think that our economic, our domestic policy is in such disarray. I think that there's some obvious things that can be done that would put money back in the hands of people.
What is that? What, Margaret? What needs to be done?
Well, I think everybody's interested in the deficit. I think there are two things that you could do. You could compromise by first raising the Social Security age, which I hate the idea of doing, but in exchange for getting rid of the wealthy tax cuts and keeping the middle class tax cuts, it seems to me that would be a reasonable compromise that the Congress could both agree on. Everybody has to give something up, and let's move forward.
Well, let me ask both of you about this wealthy tax cut business. It seems to me as though most Americans are in favor of that. Why would the president want to preserve the system, the Bush tax cuts, when obviously it would reduce the deficit some, and he's got the American people behind him, and it's really kind of a democratic principle. Why wouldn't you do that? Why give up on that? He was so adamant about it just a couple months ago.
Margaret, why don't you take first crack?
The other thing is, I wonder if you guys have read Robert Reich's Aftershock.
I haven't read it yet, no.
He talks a lot about the wage discrepancy. And that in the 50s, people were happier because only 8% of the population owned, you know, controlled the GDP.
Yeah, it's huge. The gap is huge. So
the gap is huge. And so, no, I don't understand. I mean, the tax cuts for the middle class would seem to go some distance to reducing that. And I can't understand why we've become such a center-left nation.
All right, Rick, you want to continue?
I'm not sure we've become a center-left nation, to pick up on Margaret's last point. I think there are a couple of, there are the things that Margaret mentioned, raising Social Security retirement age, which makes sense on its own, has fairly strong opposition, at least according to the most recent polls, in the country. Most people, even the two new debt commission, deficit commissions that have reported, one of them, the Bowles and Simpson Commission, was suggesting a two-year rise, I think, in the retirement age over the next 70 years. I mean, they were not rushing to do this either. There is a political dynamic that makes any of these things very difficult to achieve. And to say, well, the compromise is we raise the retirement age, and I think you said give up the tax cuts. Am I right about that, Margaret?
Give up
that
the tax cuts for the wealthy, yes.
Right, I think.
The over 250,000.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me. I would take a hard look, frankly, at the tax cuts for the people under $250,000. When President Bush proposed them, it was because the economy was going great guns. There was a surplus. The government shouldn't be taking people's money when there's a surplus, he said. Give the money back. Okay, well, now there's not a surplus. So what's the argument for extending the cuts when we have so much of a deficit problem right now?
Right,
but I think
understand.
All of these things are massively difficult politically. I think the single biggest, and from my point of view, I guess most destructive legacy of the Reagan presidency was the explosion of the idea. By explosion, I mean expansion of the idea, exploded all over the country, that taxes are by definition bad things, that you can have all the services you want and don't have to pay taxes, and taxes are bad, and you can balance the budget in your spare time too. But I think what has happened is the conversation is so tilted in that direction that the mere idea of ending a tax cut that was written for 10 years, was due to expire in 10 years, is about to expire as the law provided, which was understood at the time to be a 10-year tax cut, and which was passed in a time of surplus, as we mentioned. The idea of ending that is characterized successfully by the Republicans as a tax increase, not to mention a job-killing tax increase. And people are so wired to oppose any tax increase of any sort on anybody that even the folks over $250,000, the rest of the country is to some degree sympathetic with keeping that. Certainly they don't want their own tax cut ending in 10 years, the people under $250,000. So it's become massively difficult to have an adult conversation about paying for the services that somebody wants, that somebody else down the block may need. And it's incredibly difficult to make that happen. I'm glad that there are these deficit commissions that are at least getting the conversation going, and it would be very nice if that conversation could continue in a, you know, constructive manner.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you so much, friend. Have a really nice Thanksgiving.
And the very same to you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
All the best to you.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in. Rick Horowitz joining us. He was listening, and so he called in. And we had a good hour. Our guest, I don't know what happened to our guest. I hope he's okay. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing the hour. Thanks to Rick, and thanks for all of your calls, everyone. We'll be back.